And now here we are all of these years later, finally beginning to understand what it actually means to let them share our experience of living in time with them.
Welcome back to Cosmosis. I'm your host, Kelly Chase, along with my co-host, J. Christopher King. Before we begin, I just wanted to say how much we appreciate all of you who have been tuning in and supporting the show. If you're new here, Cosmosis is a podcast that grew out of our recent docuseries, Cosmosis, UFOs, and a New Reality, produced by our media company, Ontocalypse Productions. After more than a year of working on the series, we realized that there was so much more to explore, so many ideas, insights, and stories that didn't make it into the final cut. This podcast is our way of continuing that journey, diving deeper into the concepts and experiences that are shaping our understanding of reality. But don't worry, if you haven't seen the docuseries yet, you can absolutely follow along with the podcast. But if you like what you hear, we hope you'll check it out. Cosmosis, UFOs, and a New Reality is available now on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, Fandango at Home, Vimeo, YouTube, and more. You can find all the links at cosmosis.media. And if you'd like to support the show and help us keep these conversations going, consider joining us on Patreon. Patrons get early access to ad-free episodes and other exclusive perks. You can find all the details at patreon.com/cosmosismedia.
Today's guest is someone that both Kelly and I admire immensely, Whitley Strieber. Whitley hasn't just courageously led the way as a public experiencer, who has had to navigate the stigma that comes with all that. He's also one of the most important thinkers in the realm of anomalous experience and contact with non-human intelligence. His work has been deeply influential to both of us. Books like Them and The Supernatural, which he co-authored with Jeffrey Kripal, are essential reading for anyone seriously grappling with the complexities of anomalous phenomena. But Whitley's work can be challenging, even for other experiencers, and people who live their lives steeped in the subject. We encourage you to listen with an open mind. You don't have to come to conclusions about anything. Whitley's decades of direct experience interacting with NHIs give him a perspective that is both deeply challenging and immeasurably valuable. And stay tuned for a new deep dive episode that will drop in a couple weeks, where we will talk in much more detail about how to approach the most mind-bending experiencer narratives. Whitley's new book, The Fourth Mind, is the first ever work to seriously explore the anatomy, brains, genetics, beliefs, and capabilities of the beings he refers to as the visitors, what many others might call the grays. It's obviously difficult to say anything with certainty about these entities without having a physical specimen to study. But Whitley has spent decades piecing together what may be the most accurate portrait of them to date, using both his own experiences and the accounts of others. Though his methods may seem unconventional, I can tell you firsthand, as the director of the Experiencer Group, that members of the intelligence community are eager to collect exactly this kind of firsthand testimony from other experiencers, because right now, it could just be the best source of data we actually have. Whitley's vision, not just the biology of these beings, but of who they are, what they want, and what their relationship to us might be, are as staggering as they are surprising. His insights give us a glimpse into what may truly be happening behind our interactions with some of these beings.
And as a side note, I have the honor of being the monthly guest host of Whitley's long-running and iconic podcast, Dreamland, which was originated by the legendary Art Bell. You can catch me over there doing interviews once a month. If you're listening when this episode drops on March 7th, my recent interview with the brilliant Joshua Cutchin, author of Ecology of Souls and another expert that was featured in our docuseries, will have just gone live. I hope when you're done with this episode that you'll check it out. You can find Dreamland wherever you listen to podcasts or at unknowncountry.com. Before we dive into this conversation, here's a clip from Cosmosis, where Whitley discusses the complexities of what happens to the human mind when we encounter the truly unknown.
When we first start out in the world, we're a tabula rasa. And what the brain begins to do is it begins to make comparisons. It builds an image of reality over the first few years of life. When you're first born, you probably see very unformed symbolic images, if anything. But by the time you're three or four, you know a door is a door, a house is a house, and you have an immediate awareness of what's around you. But when something that isn't from this reality enters into it, the brain suddenly has trouble. An adult in confronting an unknown phenomenon has a lot of trouble forming it into what it actually is. So there's a gap between what's out there and what we're seeing, but we don't know how that gap works because we can't tell the difference.
So Whitley, Jay and I have absolutely loved reading your new book, The Fourth Mind. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and why you called it The Fourth Mind?
Okay, the book came into my third mind about a year and a half ago. And it seemed to me something that would be impossible to write, which is why I started. That's always the first criterion for me when I'm working. If it feels impossible, that's what I have to try to do. I've got another one in my head right now like that, and I managed how to write it, which is probably will be my next book. And we're not going to talk about that today, though. What happened was I looked back across my body of work and also into the social situation with the experience. And I thought to myself, where are we now and where do we need to go? Because communion, the cover of communion, more than anything written inside it, initiated contact between the average person and this, what we now call non-human, whatever it is. I call the visitors, and I'm not sure even that's a good name. So looking at that, I thought to myself, something is wrong with us. Something's gone wrong here. There's something wrong here. Because this relationship is not working. Why couldn't they have just come into relationship with us? What has prevented that from happening? Because something has. Is it that they didn't want it? Well, that's probably part of it. Is it that we don't want it, but aren't looking at that quite clearly? I think that's a big part of it. And that's where the book kind of started, was with that level of exploration of where we were and where I have been on my own writing journey. And I came to realize there's something missing in us that isn't missing in them. And that's the fourth mind. We live in three levels of being. We live in what's in the brain called the limbic system, which is where the autonomous nervous system is located. And it's where your guts, intelligence rules. Second level would be the emotions, where the emotions rule, and the third level is the intellect. And those three working together are a human being. This human being is moving through time. We are aware of that because of the fact that everything, every instant for us, is always new. It's always new. There's never a moment, except in some kind of a unusual precognitive state, when we see beyond the instant. And I realized that in order to be as our visitors are, they cannot be like that. They must have, at least to some extent, an awareness of more than the instant, an awareness that goes into the past, not in the same way we would think of as history, but much more viscerally. In other words, and into the future the same way. Their moment is larger because they aren't entirely in the stream of time. And I began to think of us as like fish swimming in a river, and everything is coming toward us. Everything that we need to be fed is coming toward us. And they are on the bank looking into the river. And they see a certain distance in the future and a certain distance in the past. This is why when you are with them, it is so hard to look into those big black eyes and into what lies beneath them. The fourth mind looks at time from outside. We are in the first three minds. We are always inside that fourth level. They are, to some extent, outside. I know they can't be completely outside of it because they have a bad habit of making predictions that don't come true.
So what do you think is the relationship between us and them? As beings who are kind of outside of the stream of time, what is it about us that they find interesting or important enough to have interactions with us?
Well, that's a really good question, because you'd think perhaps nothing. However, there was a piece published in a science magazine in April of 1977 that years ago, when Hal Puthoff and I first met, Hal and I have been friends forever now. I can hardly remember a time in my life when I didn't know Hal, but we met after communion, so there was a long time in my life and his life we didn't know each other. In any case, he showed me an article in Science by E.B.H. Kuyper and Mark Morris, which is a remarkable article and has stayed with me all of these years. I read it often because it's one of the single most important things ever said about this subject. The article theorizes that if aliens were here, as they call them, they would necessarily not come into direct. And the reason is that they would be here for innovation, to experience the new. And as soon as they came into contact with us, we would refocus entirely toward them, because we would want what they have, obviously. If they came here from some other dimension or across the reaches of space, we would want to be able to do that. So the hell with our own cultural and social progress and intellectual progress. Now we're refocused on theirs, and we want to take theirs in. Therefore, if they are going to find anything new here from us, they have to hide. And that, I think, is the correct and fundamental reason at one level they do hide. There are a lot of other reasons that they hide, of course, but I think the most fundamental one is they're here to experience the new.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
And that's why Anne, my wife, who's absolute genius, who seemed like such a sweet, ordinary person, a cute gal from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And this is why I'm always so suspicious when this stuff goes underground and ends up in the secret government, because they're not going to stumble upon a young kid from Ann Arbor, Michigan, who happens to have access to the secrets of the ages. And she did, because she sees the one who said, it's not about contact, Whitley. This is something more. It's about communion, and got me to call the book Communion. She understood that from the very beginning. And now here we are all of these years later,
finally beginning to understand what it actually means to let them share our experience of living in time with them. To, you know, one of them once, I used to go out in the woods at night late alone, because at first I said, Annie, we were talking, when we it took about 6 weeks for us to get to the point where we realized that this had been some kind of contact with non-human beings. And so I said, well, let's go out in the woods at night and see if they'll come back. Because if we go to the place that they took me from and we meditate there, maybe they'll realize that and they'll come back and interact with us. And she said, great idea. Why don't you start tonight? I said, well, wait a minute. She said, no, I didn't get taken up in a flying saucer by little men. You did. You want to meet the little men again? You go out in the woods and do it. Okay. I said, she said, I have a little boy here that I've got to take care of and protect. I'm no way I'm leaving this house with him asleep in bed, which was obvious. I mean, when I think of it. So off I went in the woods night after night after night. And one night, there were very few contacts. There were a few, and they were very important when they did happen. But I wish I could say, oh, we sat down together on a log, and we put our arms around each other's shoulders, and we communicated telepathically, and it was so cool. And they gave me the secrets of the universe and all kinds of wonderful downloads. And no, nothing even close. What would happen would be, I would go out in the woods alone, deeper and deeper, and get more and more uneasy with my little flashlight and going along the paths. And one night, this is one of the incidents where something happened. I became aware of the fact that there was someone standing just beside the path in just behind some brush. It scared me for a moment because I thought, it's a person, you know. And I was about a mile out from the house. I thought to myself, being out here in the dead of the night with someone who's not showing themselves at all could be very bad news. You know, I had visions of serial killers and all that. But then I stopped and I could see in my mind's eye, not physically, an old, what looked in my mind's eye to be an old, little old man. Not, it didn't look like an alien. It looked like a little man about 3 or 4 feet tall who was very, very old. And I knew it was one of them, and because they can make you see whatever they want you to see of themselves. He was communicating to me that he was very old, and he was also not showing his actual face because he was aware of the fact, I'm sure, that I was out there alone and I might have run off if I'd seen him the way he really looks. Unless that is what he looked like. I don't know. And I stopped. And I could feel that he was there to answer questions. And so I have made some pretty absurd moves in moments like that, but this one wasn't. I said, what does the universe mean to you? There came back immediately the most startling thing, one of the most startling things I've ever known. A vivid image, like a television image in full color of a coffin. A coffin. And I was so shocked because I thought it would be something much more romantic and human and grand and full of mystery and question. But then I realized they've come to the end of space-time. And I understood why they were here, because we have not. And they do not want to take us in one instant to the end of space-time like they are. They want to share our journey. And that sharing is what communion is all about. That's why she called it communion, because on some level she knew this immediately.
Fascinating. From your decades of interactions, are there other aspects that you'd like to point out in terms of how are the Greys different, but then also how are they more similar to us than we might expect?
Well, in order to find the scraps of similarity, I think we have to explore the vast ocean of differences, because they are really different from us. First of all, I do not think the physical world is their primary location, their ground. This is not their ground. And that makes an enormous amount of difference. Second, we are a vocal species. We speak. This is how we communicate. They are not. They do not speak. They are telepathic. This means we are, each of us, an island unto themselves, because we do not function telepathically. You can, but it's, many people can anyway, but it's not part of our social structure at all. They do. They are a group mind, and the military people have spread this phrase hive mind, which is the most annoying thing, one of the many annoying things about their very truncated attempt to understand this that's beginning to emerge into the public space more and more lately. It is that not a hive mind at all. It is a vast group of individuals who are linked together, and the linkage is their mind. They have one mind and many personalities. And I will tell you, I have been in that mind briefly a few times, and the thing about it that is so shocking is how quiet it is. And you know instantly, just a second in that mind, and you know why they are here. Because this is not quiet. We're not quiet at all. And to them, every single one of us is a complete separate universe. They are one, and we are many. And this is like a tremendous find for them. I know from my experience with them, they are aware of the fact that vocal species are uncommon in the universe. The reason they are uncommon is they don't last long. They fight, they argue, they explode, they die. And one of the reasons they're here, I think, is to try to prolong the lifespan of this remarkable vocal species that they have found.
That's so fascinating. You spoke a little bit about the cover of Communion and the impact that that had on people, not just a kind of recognition among people who have encountered beings that looked like that, but also there seems to be this kind of deeper, more profound, transcendent experience that some people have had, many people have had when viewing that cover. Can you talk a little bit about why you chose to use that very same imagery from Communion on the cover, but it has some distinct differences from the original cover, and how that represents the evolution of how you've come to understand these beings?
The original cover of Communion reflects as best I was able my experience of being face to face with them. And it's certainly, there are a few photographs of them, two or three, that I think are them. One of them is of a pregnant woman coming up out of a cellar in Mexico. It's just a little brief image. And I think it's real because of the fact that it looks so much like what I lived with and saw. But so that was what I had then. And there was a reflectivity of oneself in that was remarkable. But over the years, I've had a few memories of, and I'm in it now, just closing my eyes and thinking back, of seeing
a very different sort of eye. And they're not really memories. They're lower level than that. They're sort of vague, very vague, but in a way I'm pushing them away because they're very challenging emotionally. But other people, other experiencers, most notably, the most I've spoken about it most excessively, is one called a gentleman called Steve Neal, whom I've known for years and has his own YouTube channel and so forth, and he's an artist, and he's described seeing them without the eye coverings. Now, that gets me to the Reddit document. A friend said, there's something on Reddit that I think you should see. A very close friend, someone who knew that I know more about the bodies of the visitors than I was ever been able to talk about, because I didn't have any comparatives at all. And there were, in that document, it was rich with comparatives. The first and greatest one was the way they evacuate waste from their bodies, which is very different from us. And I've seen that done, and suddenly there it was in the Reddit document. But also in the Reddit document was the fact that these black things are eye coverings. And I thought to myself, this document is real. Somebody who knew this wrote this, because they couldn't have known this otherwise. It's, yes, about the eye coverings, but most certainly about the system of evacuating waste, which I've seen them actually doing. And I never spoke of it to anyone. I mentioned it to Bud Hopkins, and he was so disgusted. He said, Whitley, you have a sick mind, and that's got to be some kind of nightmare. So just forget it. It can't be true. And I thought, well, okay, I agree. It's pretty weird. I never spoke of it again. I never thought of it again. And now there it was in that document. So that's where the eye coverings idea comes from. And it's vague memories of mine, experiences like Steve Neal, and confirmed then by the Reddit document. And it's time anyway for us to see them in a new way, which is what the book is about, what Fourth Mind is about. It's time for us to start seeing them in a new way. And this is a good place to start, because if those are eye coverings and we're right, and they take them off, if my memory, my vague memory, is anything close to reality or Steve Neal's memories, then that's going to be a really explosive experience for us.
Thank you so much. I really deeply appreciate that response. Another thing that we've been kind of circling around, but maybe deserves some more depth here, is talking about the idea that this intelligence, the intelligence behind these encounters, is deeply entangled with us.
It's deeply entangled with us in many ways. I suspect that the visitors who are here now, the grays who are here now, and the tall whites who are with them in some way, would like us to believe that they've been here forever. But I do think they probably have information about us from the past. But I don't think they have been here forever. Because if they have been here forever, then I doubt we will ever be able to communicate together successfully. Because if they've been trying to for thousands of years and have gotten to where they are now, forget it. They're not going to make it. It's too late. They can't do it. But I think they can do it, and we can do it. And I think they have been. I think they were attracted to emerge here into the physical because they saw that we were self-destructing, and they have probably been making use of us in various ways, and they don't want us to self-destruct. There's a level of it that I've seen emerging lately that has kind of touched the surface a few times, that I am concerned about. It is that the military, which approaches this from a profoundly religious standpoint, has found someone and a public experiencer who can reinforce the idea that this is essentially a religious experience and a Christian religious experience, etc. And the visitors will do anything to, if it's not the right, quite the right word, but to ingratiate themselves with us, to allow us to enable us to open ourselves to them. And I'm not sure that that's a direction we want to go in, because we've done it in the past, I'm certain. I think that the ones that are here now have an awareness of that past. That's why Hudson saw an image of a cow in the sky right before the lady appeared to him. And he sees the lady as the Virgin Mary. But of course, the cow is Hathor, the ancient Egyptian goddess. And at the cabin, they would often make reference to ancient deities in the symbology of their appearances there. And I don't think any of that is absolutely as real. I think that those are attempts to invest themselves in levels of our culture that are similar or may lead us in directions of contact that would be useful to them. In other words, I think that some of them would be very comfortable with us worshiping them as gods, because then we would not be so difficult to deal with. And I think we need to be difficult to deal with in order for this relationship to become real. And, you know, they know that, I'm sure, too. And that's why there's such an enormous difference between different levels of the close encounter experience, which you guys are very sensitive to, that there's a highly sophisticated level of it, and a level of sophistication, intellectual sophistication, and emotional content as well, that is at the cutting edge of the way we understand reality. And then there are other levels, and you go down and down until finally you have people who are trying to reconnect with them through the medium of the old religions. And so we have to find our way out of that, beyond that. Otherwise, the reconnection will be just as false now as it was in the past. Those old gods are not external to us. They're aspects of human psychology that we observed as separate, because I don't think we fully understood ourselves then. But if you look at the old gods, at the Egyptian gods or the living Hindu gods, you will find that they are aspects of the human psyche.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
You know, something that I love and admire so much about your work, Whitley, is that there are no easy answers. And you really talk about the phenomenon in a way, you know, making it clear that there is an objective external reality to this phenomenon, while also a real internality to it, a subjectivity to it that also permeates everything. And it seems like that's sort of what we're circling around here. Can you talk a little bit more about how this sort of internality and externality, the subjectivity and objectivity that is kind of permeated throughout the experience of the phenomenon, what that can tell us about the phenomenon and the intelligence behind it?
Well, thank you. I always enjoy a simple question.
Right? I'm good at that.
Okay. I'm tempted to say, well, let's get back to this in about 6 weeks. But no, that's the great Kelly Chase question. That's the kind of question I love hearing from you, Kelly. The subjective-objective aspects can be looked upon in a number of different ways, either personally or socially. It would be two. And if you look upon them personally, it becomes a challenge. You know, what am I going to do with this? Am I going to try to see it as something outside of me? And if so, how am I going to relate to it? And this gets to the social level of this. Am I going to relate to it through the medium of things I already understand about the world or believe? Or am I going to try to neutralize that level of my mind and see it as clearly as I can for what it may be, even though I know the difficulty that the brain has when it doesn't have any relational material with which to compare an impression that's coming in. The brain is a comparative mechanism. For example, when light stuff comes into the eyes, the brain's processing is in the optic nerve is a small part of it. The much larger processing is going on in different parts of the brain, which are bringing together memories that relate to what's being seen. This is why the world is consistent and looks the way it does to us. But when something comes in that does not fit any of that, we become like babies again. We're suddenly without any reference points. And this is one of the reasons it can be so terrifying to be with the visitors. But it gets back to this subjective-objective thing. Are we going to then make subjective decisions? This is Jesus. This is Mary. This is an ancient god. This is a fairy folk. This is that. Or are we going to try to stand back from that in another space that is much more powerful and say, I don't know. I am face to face with something that is alive, that is vividly present right now, and I don't know. That takes courage. And without that courage, we will fail to go forward in a useful way.
That's a great response. Maybe I don't know is the answer to this question that I'm about to present here, but
I don't know.
Damn it. You got me. along similar lines, of course, you have written quite a lot and spoken about how seriously and regularly you take your meditation practice. And
yes,
like a lot of fellow experiencers, one of the exercises that you perform within meditation is contact work. And, I hear within the experiencer group a lot of reports from folks about their contact experiences. And some people feel like they're being contacted by their quote-unquote guides or a higher self or, some people, it even presents as maybe Hathor or Athena, or there are these kinds of, archetypal gods that seem to come to people. Or, the NHI, the non-human, if we're going to call it that, intelligence presents itself as such. So along those lines, are we talking, when you're in that kind of contact work, and when you're in meditation, do you find it helpful to delineate between these NHI? Do you think that it's important or necessary to figure out, is this what some people could think of as a guide or a higher self, or is this the grays, for example? And, do you think that there's any reason to delineate between these different taxonomies, really?
Well, first of all, I know the grays much too well to, if I thought of them as guides, they would misguide me for sure out of anger. They don't want that. They're not interested. They want participation. They want friendship, basically, deeper than normal friendship. They want a friendship that enables them to enter our experience of life and to be in it, so that they get the taste of the new again as well. And that is a very physical thing, because you have to let their consciousness into yours, and you have to share. That's why a little while ago I said I know what it's like to be inside their mind.
I do, because I've shared myself with them. I share myself with them as carefully as much as I can, but carefully, because, you know, I mean, they are like any addict. They'll take everything they can if they can. And they are addicted to us. That's why they're here. They're addicted to recovering what they lost, because they essentially lost everything of value when they lost the present, when they lost the moment. They lost any reason to live. I've been with them in the outside of time state a couple of times, and it's like riding rails. That it's not forever. In other words, it's not to the end of the universe, but you know, suddenly there's no novelty to the moment. It's appalling. It's like a nightmare. You know, I'll give you an example of how it feels to people, because it happened to Jeff Kripal, my co-author of Supernatural and the founder of the Archives of the Impossible at Rice, for those of you who do not know what this towering and hilariously diffident man is. He is that. He's both things. Anyway, there were conferences at the Esalen Institute from time to time. This has nothing to do with that billionaire conference that went on where they did orb tourism and stuff. No, it's something very much deeper than that and much more private, so I'm not going to go into it too much. But suffice to say, there's a room at the house where the conferences take place where I like to sleep in that room, because it's, you open the door and you walk 10 feet to a cliff overlooking the Pacific Ocean. And this means the visitors can come from underwater, and they're intimately engaged underwater, and come right into the room very easily without having to go through cities or anything like that. So it's a very physical moment. And people knew that. And at the time, there were two beds in that room. And Jeff decided he would like to try to see if he could engage them. And I said, great, let's do it. And they did. One of them did show up that night. And it showed up briefly for me and a few minutes later for Jeff. Here's Jeff's reaction. Now, at that point, and now I'm used to this. It's not, you know, I'm not going to be taken out of the time stream. They're not here to take me out of the time stream, but to enter it, to use me to enter it themselves. So they're hardly going to take me out of it. So, and I know that now. So I'm not frightened by this type of approach. Jeff did not know that. You can't know it by being told. You have to experience it. So suddenly he was awakened. I don't think he's ever said exactly what it was, but he experienced what sounded to him like a flood of broken glass pouring down all around him. And then he heard from deep within his body his own voice cry out, "Oh my God." And this was because the mere presence of this being was drawing his soul out of the stream of time, simply because of his relationship with what it knew. And we are here to live in the stream of time. There's nothing wrong with this. We're here to fill our souls with experience in the time stream. And you can't do it from outside the time stream. Their souls are frozen for that reason. It's in the time stream that the growth occurs. And Jeff felt himself being pulled out of it. And the fear of being alive and dead at the same time is a greater fear than the fear of death. And he tasted that for an instant. That's what, and you know, when you get these people going on orb tourism, and they fortunately for them, they just look at the orbs. They don't try to engage with them, because if they did, it might be very difficult.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
Where do we start with this? I've sort of circled around it. So it's sort of,
oh, that's great. Oh, I love that. Oh,
that's great. Absolutely. I think part of this was looking at the delineation between NHI and whether it's useful to really look at taxonomy and difference, you know, partially for safety or just so that for pure knowledge, you know, these kinds of reasons. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, this is the reason that we have to be careful here. The other thing is that they will take you over. They will take over people who don't, who are unresponsive and don't have any way of relating to them. They will use people. And there's even been some confused physical stuff that's gone on. They do the cattle mutilations. This is them. And they do this because cattle have a very rich copper content. And as I point out in the fourth mine, their bones are filled with not with marrow, but with a type of copper. And it's there because their craft have an extremely high intensity magnetic field. And this presence of this copper in the bones of these biomechanical beings, that this is not the regular ones, I don't know what's in their bones. The presence of the copper will heat in a magnetic field. It's not magnetically sensitive, but a high-intensity magnetic field will heat it. So they have their own internal heating. They don't have to have it, you know, when they're in very cold environments in these objects. So that's what the cattle mutilations are about. There have been a few, apparently, I mean, I've got enough information to suggest that this probably does happen from time to time. Human mutilations, basically from beings that are not familiar with us and not aware of the fact that you know, they shouldn't do that to us because they're not going to succeed here if they do. But getting back to how to have a relationship here, how do we actually have a relationship with someone who is desperate to re-enter the stream of time, is kind of addicted to us, and who's not going away, who is much more intelligent than us, and much more, and not in native intelligence probably, but in experience and knowledge. How do we do this in such a way that we control our side of this relationship? And that's the huge question. And it's why I'm so concerned is I want to circle back again to the people who are trying to fit it into past mythologies. That's no way to control a relationship that is going to go out of control as it has been in the past.
That's actually the perfect lead up to the question I wanted to ask, Whitley, which is, so this last year at Contact in the Desert, Jay hosted a panel of experiencers that you were on along with Yvonne Smith and many other names that people will recognize. And it was a really important moment for me because near the end, Jay asked the question about what everyone's impression on the stage was about what the purpose was of our contact with these entities. And I was so surprised, and probably I shouldn't have been, but I learned a lot from this, which was that everyone on stage said that it was about telepathy, that it was about like we as humans recovering this ability that we had lost and that was critically important for us to recover at this moment to kind of save ourselves. And, you know, that changed how I looked at everything. I think I've thought about that every day since. But then also, you know, in reading The Fourth Mind and in hearing you talk through all this, it seems as though, you know, we do need to recover some of that and able in order to sort of save ourselves at this moment as a species. But it sounds like there's also a certain risk involved in us becoming more like them, that there's a way that we could lose our humanity and not just our humanity, but the things that we find valuable about ourselves and that they also seem to find valuable about us. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of that conflict and that struggle between the need to become more like them without losing ourselves.
That is one of the best questions I've ever heard. A big part of The Fourth Mind is the timing. It's the time for the book. I do have a certain amount of extratemporal awareness because of my connection with the Grays, which is only enough to enable me to time things correctly. And that's why the book came out when it did. And also why, on a deeper level, Kai Dickens and Diane Hennessy Powell brought forth the idea of the telepathy tapes and the spellers who are telepathic when they did, and why that was so important to all of these wired in experiencers at that panel, because this is the time we need to be able to do that. But the question is how, because do we want to end up like them in a state of isolation from the moment? I don't think so. We need to be able to do this in the moment and stay in the moment. They are a great lesson to us in this respect, because their state and the situation they're in stands as a warning to mankind. Don't go down this path, but not that way. Don't do it in such a way that you gather enormous amounts of information from it, information that you don't actually need in order to live. And what we need to do is to become a community of mind inside the stream of time, not outside of it. And that is going to be a challenge, because the mind is questing for knowledge. And when you get into a state like that, you become very powerful in terms of knowledge. And sooner or later, you fall out of the mind of God and into your own mind, which is what they did, and which is why people think of them as demons. They're not demons. They're desperate. That's a different, an enormous difference there. How do we do this? And I think we have to think of the craft of community mind, and eventually also the art of it. The craft of it is, how do we become what you're thinking about right now, which is becoming a community mind, Kelly? How do we do that without becoming too big? Because we can easily become so big that the universe seems to us like a coffin, just like it does to them. We don't want to go down there. We want to stay in the wonder and in, therefore, the body of God.
Wow. Thank you for that, Whitley. That really touched me. Thank you.
Yeah, we had a telepathic moment there, my dear. I hope you don't mind me saying that. I'm an old-fashioned guy, and I say things like that every once in a while. Please, if it triggered you, please accept my apologies.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Oh, that's great. I appreciate that. And a fantastic question and a great response. You know, just then you were using them and their. Of course, Them was a fantastic book. And I think Kelly and I both feel close to Them, the book that you wrote a few years ago, because it was basically when both of us got to know you better on a more personal level. And it's not just that it's a great book, but there's also, I think, a little bit of sentimentality for both Kelly and I in looking back on Them, because, of course, we became like literally introduced to you while you were getting that together, going through the communion letters again down at Rice and the Archives of the Impossible, etc. So touching on that briefly towards the end of this episode, so we can kind of look at the fourth mind and Them. Because there does seem to be a relationship between these two books, and they,
yes,
you know, they take different tactics to accomplish this, but they're interesting bookends for sure. So along those lines, the title Them, again, kind of teasing out the nuance that we're talking about here, the title Them suggests both separateness and interconnection. How do you define Them now? And has that definition changed over time for you?
Well, first I have to say about the title. The title comes from a movie from the 1950s, a wonderful horror movie called Them. And each chapter was intended to have an epigraph from the script. But unfortunately, the script's copyright is in limbo. Maybe no one owns it. Maybe someone does. I couldn't find out. And I decided that I did not wish to put myself out on a limb and use these epigraphs. But the reason for it is this. The reason that the movie, if you look at it, it is reflective of many different things about our actual present relationship. It's very prophetic in the sense that the fear of the government, of the unknown, and its job, after all, is to preserve us from threats. And so at first in the movie, it's sort of agreed among the various players that, no, the public mustn't know anything about this because we don't know what it is yet. And then, of course, the next thing you know, giant ants are marching through Los Angeles, and something not too far from that might happen sooner or later, even now. We have to try to see this in a way that accepts and encloses our fears and makes them a part of the narrative that we can use to deepen our understanding rather than the part of the narrative that is central to our experience. Right now, the so-called insiders, that's where they are. They're bragging publicly about calling in the visitors and then shooting them down. Now, what's actually happening there is very different from what they think. They think to themselves, oh my goodness, we're successful here, shooting them down. And yes, they are, but they don't understand that what's in these things is a biological robot that's a projection of someone who's not there physically. So it's perfectly possible that it could be destroyed. That's why when you're approached by the visitors to be abducted, there might be people who often say, well, there was a taller one in the background, but the ones that came to my bedside were all short. That was because they were like avatars of the taller one. They were just as competent mentally, but that was because the soul or the consciousness of the other one was projected into them. So they were like extensions of physical extensions of the other one's being. Understanding what's actually going on in those shootdowns is not easy for these people. What is happening is they're being trained. It's a training program. They want, when they get psionically contacted, they expect the shootdown to occur because they told me years ago, and this is in the book, The New World, my book, A New World, that we have to be able, that level of the human species has to feel that it can defend itself or the relationship can't work. And so that's what they are literally training them. And then Jake Barber describes how something came out of the craft that he was trying to pick up from that had presumably been shot down and entered him. And it was a beautiful feminine presence. And he's so glad it's still in him. And he said, it's not ontological shock. It's more like ontological relief. And I thought to myself, that is ontological shock. He's talking about ontological shock without thinking about what it is. He doesn't understand it. And what it is, what was done was he was being tamed so that he would be able to take this to another level. And he will, because this will stay in him. It was literally like, it's not an entity. It's a It's a more of a frequency that that connects with the parts of his his brain and body, I guess, in probably in his limbic system, that will produce feelings of peace and security and a numinous presence in him. And it gives him a chance to grow out of the fear and the hostility that he has been living in. So it's all part of a training program. They're childlike in that. I don't want to condescend, but do they really seriously think the visitors, the Greys, don't know their secrets already? Of course they do.
Oh, gosh. That is funny. You know, something that struck me so much, Whitley, about the fourth mind compared to your other work is that there is an urgency to it. There's a sense that this is something that you really felt you needed to write, and you needed to write it now. And since we're coming up to the end of our hour, and this will probably be our last question, I wanted to make sure to ask you about that urgency. What makes it so urgent, and what do you hope that people do in response to this work? Like, what is our next? What should our next step be?
Well, nature is going to make us take our next step. This species is being born. We're going down the birth canal, and we're either going to be born alive or born dead. In that sense, the entities that are around us are midwives. And they obviously, if they're midwives, they do want us to be born alive. But they're practical midwives, and if we're born dead, they'll make do with that. And we can talk later about what the difference would be. In any case, what's happening here now, and it's part of the way the thing works. If you look at the long count calendar of what's called astrology now, you will find that each astrological sign lasts about 2,000 years, and the precession of the equinox matches the transition from the age we're in now, Pisces, to the next age, because what's happening in the planet reflects that very clearly. In Pisces, the little fish swims around in the waters of life and is given everything it needs. Everything it needs. That is to say, the little embryo that's humanity is swimming around in the waters of life of the earth. And earth has been giving us everything we needed right along. Now, the waters are about to break. That's why you see the water pourer, the Aquarius, the water carrier, pouring out her water. And where the little fish is in the water, and the little fish ends up on dry land. Now, what do we do? And all of the gnashing of teeth and whining and yelling and screaming that's going on is the baby coming down the birth canal and wondering, what in the heck is this? And we're in denial right now. And that's okay, because mama doesn't care. Mama can't do anything about the fact that we're in the birth canal any more than we can. We're being born. So let's stop the first hour on that note. We're being born. We are born.
That's it for this episode. Cosmosis is brought to you by Ontocalypse Productions. If you want to check out our docuseries, Cosmosis, UFOs, and a New Reality, head over to cosmosis.media to find out where to watch. Make sure you're subscribed so you never miss an episode. And if you're watching on YouTube, don't forget to like this video, leave a comment, and ring the bell for notifications. It really helps the show, and it keeps the conversation going. Music for the Cosmosis Conversations is by Michael Rubino. The soundtrack for season one of Cosmosis is now available on all major streaming platforms, and you'll find links in the episode description. If you want to go even deeper and support our work, join us on Patreon. You'll get early access to ad-free episodes, exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and monthly Zoom calls with us and special guests. You can sign up now at patreon.com/cosmosismedia. Join us next week for part two of our thought-provoking conversation with the legendary Whitley Strieber. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.